From the Commonwealth Club of California, I'm Greg Dalton, and this is Climate One, leading the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. On the show today, we're going on an adventure with the legendary explorer and entrepreneur Yvon Chouinard. The pioneering founder and owner of Patagonia is known for charting his own path through the wilderness and through business. Rather than pushing customers to buy new jackets and gear, his company helps people fix buttons and zippers and collects worn-out clothes for recycling. In an industry not known for its social and environmental responsibility, the company is a leader in understanding the impacts of its operations on people and the planet, and works hard to do no unnecessary harm. All that effort drives up costs, but Yvon Chouinard doesn't give a dang. As a private company, the only shareholder sits across from him at the dinner table every night. Yvon Chouinard and his wife Melinda spent about half the year in the mountains of Wyoming, far from corporate headquarters on the California coast north of Los Angeles. He just published his revised and updated memoir, Let My People Go Surfing, The Education of a Reluctant Businessman. Please join me in giving a round, rousing welcome to Yvon Chouinard. Welcome, Yvon Chouinard.
Thank you.
Let's begin on an important evening in your life, 1956. It's your high school prom, and what are you doing?
I'm down at the LA River bottom down there gigging frogs and catching crawdads.
So rather than everyone else is at the dance, you're in the river chasing frogs.
Yeah, I was never a dancer, actually.
And you also spent time going to, I guess you were 8 years old or so, going to the golf course, fishing. You were what we call today free-range kid.
Yeah, my whole childhood was in nature, really. And yeah, probably when I was about eight or so, before the other kids could cross the street, I was riding a bicycle over from Burbank to Toluca Lake and sneaking on Bob Hope's golf course bass pond and catching... hiding in the reeds and catching bass. So, yeah, my whole life has been around nature, really.
Well, in 1968, you took a trip that you say shaped your life. You drove a 10,000-mile trip down the Pan American Highway. Was dirt then. So tell us about that trip and how it shaped your life.
Well, I've been on a lot of different expeditions and trips, but the longer they are, the more you get something out of them. And this was a six-month trip. And so we left Ventura, California, with an old van. This was Doug Tompkins and myself and some other folks. And we loaded the van up with surfboards and skis and climbing equipment, bought an old Bolex 16-millimeter camera, and took off surfing all the way down to Lima, went to Chile, and climbed volcanoes and skied down them. That's where I learned to ski. crossed over the Andes and went over and climbed Fitzroy, a real famous mountain that had been only climbed twice, and we did a new route on it. And we made a film on the whole thing, and that's when I fell in love with that country, the southern end of South America called Patagonia. And it affected Doug Tompkins a lot and myself. And that's why I named my clothing company Patagonia, because I wanted to make clothing for those kind of conditions, you know, like Cape Horn and wild mountains and wild weather. Yeah, so that was a big effect. That was 1968. And it was a wild trip. I mean, you know, you wake up sometimes sleeping on the ground in Guatemala with guns at your head. Had a lot of adventures.
We have a question from Facebook. Michael Cannell asks, what's cat food taste like? You know, is there a reason that you ate some interesting things on that or that trip or other times in your life?
No, that was... Yeah, when I was about 18 years old, I was spend the whole summers climbing, and we had no money whatsoever. I was living on maybe 50 cents a day. And before I left for the summer, I went to a place in San Francisco that sold dented cans. And I bought a couple of cases of dented cat food. It's not very tasty, no, but it's not dog food.
No offense to the dog owners. So you founded an outdoor gear company, you got into clothing, and at some point you realized that you were running a business, but you didn't want to be a businessman.
Well, I never wanted to be a businessman. I was a craftsman, and I was a climber. And I just, every time I'd go into the mountains, I'd have ideas on how to make the gear better. The gear was pretty crude in those days. It was all made in Europe. And so I just got myself a forge and an anvil and a book on blacksmithing, and I taught myself how to blacksmith. And that led to making these pitons and eventually ice axes and crampons and all the gear for mountain climbing, and never did it thinking that it was a business. It was at first it was just making the stuff for myself and friends, and then friends of friends, and pretty soon I'm making two of these pitons an hour and selling them for $1.50 each. Well, not too profitable, right? But yeah, that's I kind of backdoored becoming a businessman, because this is in the '60s, and you know, businessmen were all greaseballs in the '60s. This is a counterculture that we were in, and we didn't respect business. In fact, they were the enemy. And so, one day later on, I kind of woke up and discovered, oh my God, I am a businessman. And that's when I decided I better find out what I'm doing, and started reading a lot of books on business and basically trying to create a business that we wanted to come to work in. All of us, I mean, it wasn't just me, but all of us were all dirt bags. So that's what we did.
And explain that term, dirt bags, has a particular meaning for people who...
Well, actually, that term, dirt bag, now you hear it all the time, but it actually came from Yosemite. And I don't know where it came from, but I remember when we started using it.
People who are out in nature a lot. 1981, you had a near-death experience in an avalanche in China. One person died, others, you survived. Tell us about that near-death experience in 1981 in China.
I used to go on a lot of... I'm kind of a serial climber, you know. I'd spend 2 years just climbing cracks. I'd spend 5 years just climbing big walls like in Yosemite. I'd spent years and years learning ice climbing, in fact, writing a book about it. And then I did a bunch of expedition climbing on, you know, in the Himalayas and Antarctica and places like that. And one trip to Tibet, there was four of us coming down from Camp 2 on this 25,000-foot peak. And we set off an avalanche, and we were roped up together, and we went over a 30-foot cliff. We went about 1,500 feet, went over a 30-foot cliff, and the avalanche stopped, and we're trying to untangle ourselves from all the ropes and stuff, and we're thinking, oh, my God, we're alive. And but the avalanche started again. And at that point, we knew that at just a few hundred feet below, there was a 300-foot cliff. So we knew we were dead. And we accepted the idea that we're dead. We're going to die. And the avalanche stopped 30 feet from the cliff. And one of the guys was had a broken neck, and he was dead. Another friend had a broken back. I had broken ribs and a concussion. I had no idea where I was. And it kind of changed my life in that I've had a lot of close calls, near-death experiences, but always afterwards you go around sniffing the flowers and being really happy to be alive and everything. But after that, all of us were deeply depressed for several months afterwards. And I've read stories about people that have kind of died and come back. And you resist coming back. And in fact, it's taught me that there's nothing to fear about death itself. It's a pretty pleasant feeling. And since then, I really scared the heck out of my family. And I realized I don't want to do that again. I really cut back on that kind of climbing. But I also have an attitude that, you know, when my time comes, I'm going to go out pretty peacefully.
We have another question from Facebook for Yvonne Chouinard, founder and owner of Patagonia. Cameron DePetro asks, you said that an adventure isn't an adventure until something goes wrong. Do you still believe that to be true?
Yeah, I mean, every definition of adventure in the Webster's has risk, whether it's a financial venture or whatever. And adventure travel, that's an oxymoron. They make sure that you're not going to get into any trouble.
Sign those release forms.
Yeah. So, yeah, and, you know, if you really search out adventure, you have to purposely leave out some gear or you have to purposely stick your neck out. Otherwise, you're not going to have an adventure. If you figure it out to an nth degree, it's not going to happen. And we searched out adventure when I was a kid. It always we always dared it, you know, dared it to happen, so we could fight our way out of it. And you know, that's when you get the most value out of the experience.
Do you feel that about your own children having adventure too?
Of course not. I want them to be as safe as possible. I don't want to hear about it.
Fair enough.
In fact, the first time my parents knew I was a climber, this is 1964, they were watching television. And on the news program, there's a helicopter coming by the North American Wall of El Capitan, and then it zooms in on these guys hanging from hammocks underneath this big overhang, 2,000 feet up, and one of them is their son. They always thought when I said I was going climbing that I was going hiking.
So what was it like when you got home when they found out about that?
They were aghast, that's for sure.
10 years after that avalanche in China, your company had a near-death experience. Why did that happen, and how did you turn it around?
Well, we were growing our business in the normal ways. We were adding more wholesale accounts. We were building more retail stores. And the market wanted our products, and so we were growing 50% a year. And, you know, you can't grow a business with 50% growth year after year on retained earnings. At some point, you're going to crash. And at the same time, there was a recession, and the banks wouldn't lend us any money. We had bought inventory for another 50% growth, and as it turned out, we only had a 30% growth. Well, that's a huge difference. And we got into really deep financial trouble. I mean, so deep that I could hardly get out of it. My accountants introduced me to the mafia. who ironically wanted 28% interest, which is what you pay on your credit cards now.
Yeah, yeah.
That's mafia. And, you know, I finally got out of it by borrowing money from friends and friends of friends and stuff like that. But it also was a wake-up call that I was doing business just like everybody else. I was growing for the sake of growing and not thinking about what I was doing. And that forced us to sit down, all of us, in the company and ask ourselves, why are we in business? And in fact, I took all the most important people in the company. We went down to Patagonia, and we walked around in the wilderness, and we sit down for 3-4 hours a day and talk about, okay, why are we in business? What are we trying to do? What are our values? And that's what eventually became this book, Let My People Go Surfing. And it changed the whole way we did business. And what we did is create a business that we wanted to come to work in. And it's pretty different from a lot of other companies, I can tell you that. And it works.
Lots of companies talk about their values. They have them posted by the water cooler, et cetera, but it's a different thing to live them. So how do you operationalize them? And do you go back to them, you know, keep coming back to them? Because all CEOs and companies say they have values.
Well, for instance, our management, I mean, the name of my book is Let My People Go Surfing, because we have a policy that if your child is sick, go home, take care of them, no matter what. And I don't care when you work, as long as the job gets done. And if the surf comes up, drop everything, go surfing if you're a surfer. If you have to wait till next Thursday at 2 o'clock to go surfing, you're, like Trump would say, you're a loser. But, so, you know, none of us liked authority. We really disliked authority, and none of us wanted to tell other people what to do. So our management system is kind of like an ant colony. You know, an ant colony doesn't have any bosses. The queen just lays there and lays eggs. There's no bosses in ant colony, but every single ant knows what his job is and gets it done. And they communicate by touching feelers, and that's about it. And so in Native American societies, the chief was not the richest guy in the tribe. He was the best orator because the tribe made decisions on consensus. Now, that's the opposite of how our government works. Our government works on compromise, which never solves the problem. It cuts the baby in half, so to speak. And to build consensus, you have to have leaders that can convince everybody that we're going to go in this direction. And it's kind of like a SEAL team. If one guy in the SEAL team says, oh, I don't know about this thing we're going on, I think I'm going to just hold back a little bit. It doesn't work. Every single person in that SEAL team has to agree this is what he's going to do. And if the leader gets killed, the next guy takes over. If he gets killed, the next guy takes over. It's leaderless, really. And that's our management style. And so I hire very independent, very self-motivated people who believe in what we're trying to do, and I leave them alone. And in fact, I had a psychologist came one time and studied our company and said, gee, I got to tell you, we did psychological profiles on a lot of people, you know, to see if, make sure the right brain people were working on right brain jobs and stuff like that. But I said, I got to tell you, your people are so, the most independent people I've ever seen in a company. In fact, they're really unemployable anywhere else.
It's a good thing you gave them jobs. If you're just joining us, our guest today at Climate One from the Commonwealth Club is Yvonne Chouinard, the owner and founder of Patagonia. I'm Greg Dalton. We have another question from Facebook from Ryan Parker, who asks, which was a greater accomplishment, climbing El Capitan or founding three global companies?
Oh, boy, those are really different. It's only dawned on me recently the effect that my companies have had in society. I never really thought much about it, but you know, we're a relatively small company, but we have incredible amount of social power around the world, and it's only dawned on me recently that that we have this, and therefore we probably have the responsibility to use that power and not just hire other people to do the right thing and stuff. So it's changed the way our company operates. Instead of just giving money away to a bunch of NGOs, which we still do, but we're doing a lot more stuff ourselves. We're influencing. We're being asked to go to Washington almost every week now to give advice on dam removal. And in fact, Hillary is so sure that she's going to win, she's putting together her policy, and we're being asked to go back there in a week or two to talk. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And so I guess I'm pretty stoked about, you know, the climbs I did on El Cap. You know, they were really important for me at that time. It built the character that I am now, probably. But I'm starting to be pretty proud of the company, too.
A lot of moral authority, deep following that Patagonia has. And there was one time where you were approached by Walmart, which is a huge corporation, villainized by a lot of probably Patagonia followers. So tell us about Dancing with the Devil.
Well, a few years back, the Walton family told the CEO that they wanted a green Walmart. Basically make it more environmentally responsible. Well, the CEO had no idea what that meant. So he sent a team of, I think, 7 or 9 people to Ventura to talk to us about what it means. And also, they realized that they couldn't do what they wanted to do without getting other large companies all together doing the same thing so that there was a level playing field. And so they sent a letter out to a lot of the largest companies in America to come to New York to talk about greening their companies and doing a new way of doing business and stuff, and nobody came. So they got a hold of us and said, will you co-sign a letter, Walmart and Patagonia, inviting these people to New York, and everybody came. So we started an apparel, sustainable apparel coalition, which is kind of bogged down in bureaucracy, but the ultimate goal is to basically give information to consumers so that they know what they're buying, so that a young person buying a pair of jeans can look at 5 pairs of jeans on a table and zap the barcode, and it'll tell them how each jean is made, and it'll have a grade as to which one is made more responsibly. That's the ultimate goal, and I don't know when that's going to happen, but
do you think that sustainable purchasing, green living, is that legitimate? Can corporations be a force for the sustainability changes that you want to see, or is that just greenwashing?
Well, it has to be forced by the consumer. I don't think corporations are going to change on their own. Public corporations, I mean, Robert Reich wrote a book on capitalism. He devotes 2 chapters to why public corporations can never be responsible. But, you know, all of us here are no longer citizens, we're consumers. That's our brand now. But you know what? I used to think that maybe designers had the most power because they decide what color car you're going to drive, you know, what clothes you're going to wear and stuff. But you can just say no. That's pretty powerful. And so we have the power, and corporations will only change when we force them to. And it's the same thing with government. I'll tell you a little story about mountain guiding. There's two types of mountain guiding. One is democratic, where you're guiding somebody up the Grand Teton, which is a pretty safe mountain. The client starts freaking out, so you pull out your harmonica and you play your harmonica a little bit. You calm them down, and you kind of, you know, take your time, and you get up it. Very effective way to guide on a non-difficult mountain. Let's say you're guiding on the Matterhorn, and you know you're 60 years old, a guide, and you got a family, and remember the client is always out to kill you. And so on a mountain like that, it's rotten rock. It's thunderstorms every afternoon, and the client freaks out, the guide screams at him, pounds on him, calls him names, tugs the rope, and gets him to the top. So what happens is the client is more afraid of the guide than the mountain. And that's basically how we have to treat our government. The government won't move unless we tell them. You know, in the debates, how many times did you hear global warming? Whew. Not at all. It was half of one sentence in Hillary's acceptance speech.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Yvon Chouinard, founder and owner of Patagonia and author of the new revised and updated memoir, Let My People Go Surfing, The Education of a Reluctant Businessman. I'm Greg Dalton. I'd like to go to our lightning round. We'll go to our lightning round now, which is a series of quick, brief answer questions, answers for Yvon Chouinard. First one is, please name a living business leader for whom you have great respect.
Oh, you got me there.
Okay. Maybe this one will be... Name a living politician for whom you have great respect.
Well, a
little respect?
I think Bernie's my man. Yeah.
Name one brand of clothing other than Patagonia that you have in your home.
I got some old Levi's from going way back, I guess.
True or false, most shoppers at the mall are seeking to soothe their boredom.
Yeah, I think that's true. Absolutely.
Corporate marketers know that and manipulate people's yearning for meaning and emotional connection.
Yeah, that's the main reason we shop, is just through boredom, I think.
True or false, Patagonia has a higher gross profit margin than its competitors.
I think so.
That means you could really afford to donate 2% for the planet to avoid 2 degrees of human-caused global warming.
There are ways to do more than 1% we do more than 1%, but it's
do a lot more than
under the table type stuff. I can't really talk about it.
Back to those mafia guys. No. Many Patagonia customers spend more time driving around suburbia feeling earthy than actually getting out into nature.
Well, yeah, we're selling more and more to just kind of ordinary people, yeah.
When is the last time you dropped in on an epic wave?
Well, I know exactly. It was last winter, but then I had to get a rotator cuff operation. And it's been 6 months, and November 1st is 6 months, and that's when the doctor says I can start surfing again.
November 6th.
Okay. November 1st.
November 1st. And on November 9th, you turned 78, I believe. So let's give him an early birthday.
There's nothing to clap about being 78.
We're talking with Yvon Chouinard at Climate One from the Commonwealth Club. True or false, you could claim residency in Wyoming, which has no state income tax. Instead, you choose to pay taxes in California, a high tax state.
No, I believe in taxes. I'm happy to pay my taxes. And when I see corporations like General Electric, who paid no income taxes a few years ago, I think it's pretty sad. In fact, I believe in taxes so much that we tax ourselves. Our 1% for the planet taxes, we tax ourselves. And the best part is we decide where it goes.
You recently converted Patagonia into a B Corporation, which is a new type of corporate structure that allows companies to seek social and financial returns without worrying about getting sued by investors for not maximizing profit at the expense of all else. So the question is, you did that to ensure that your two children who will inherit the company or other future owners won't change the company's values.
Yeah, actually, they don't inherit the company, but it goes into a trust. And the law, the way it is, forces every company to become public. And, you know, if the trust, if myself and my kids die, the trust has 8 years to divest 80% of the stock, because the law doesn't want you to own more than 20% of stock in any one company, a foundation law. And it also forces you to sell to the highest bidder. You can't just sell your company to a close friend for $2. So the highest bidder for us, of course, would be going public. Well, being a B Corp, you don't have to do that. You can establish what your values are, and you put that in your corporate charter, and you can avoid that. So hopefully the company can keep going with the same values for a long, long time.
Important new category of company structure. In 2013, Patagonia launched a venture capital fund called $20 million in Change. That means you will fit right in with the blood-sucking VCs here in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's actually a lot more than $20 million. We've changed the name to Tin Shed Ventures. My tin shed is my old blacksmith shop. And so we're investing in other little startup companies that are really working on game-changing type goods, and also processes, like a company that's coming out with some waterless dyeing. So, you know, you could dye a pair of jeans without any water, which, you know, dyeing is one of the really big causes of water pollution around the world. We invested in a little startup company that collects fishing nets around the world, which are made out of nylon, and they melt them down and they make products from them. They make skateboard decks, they make sunglass frames, they make a whole bunch of different things. That's kind of the type of little small investments. And we have probably, 20 or 30 of these now. And it's not with a view to making a bunch of money and then getting out of it. We're in it for the long term, and we really believe in what these little companies are doing.
Social change. True or false for Yvon Chouinard, Howard Hughes once employed you as a private detective to keep track of his girlfriends.
Yeah, that was the only other job I've ever had.
You don't use a computer or smartphone, and your friends arrange social gatherings via email. So the question is, your friends like you, but not enough to bother making a phone call to invite you to hang out.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit out of it these days. I purposely don't do email, and I don't have a computer, and I have a cell phone, but it's strictly to... I get a heart attack, I can call out. I never turn it on. But, I'm feeling increasingly isolated because the whole rest of the world is communicating with these gizmos, and I'm not. But anyway, it's too late to change.
I will mention a noun and just single word or phrase that first comes to your mind. Whole Foods.
Whole Foods?
Whole Foods.
Well, Whole Food Markets, I guess.
Wells Fargo.
Well, thank God, I've got nothing to do with them.
Yes, the phrase that comes to your mind, Ben and Jerry's.
Those guys are friends of mine, and they did some good work.
Koch Brothers.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, that's, the idea that corporations should just maximize profits and then not get involved in anything else except maximizing profits, that's not what the Koch brothers are doing. They're using their profits to... basically do a lot of evil stuff. And so we're doing the same thing, but we're trying to do some good stuff.
Legalization of recreational marijuana.
I've been advised by my attorneys not to do...
Okay, so go surfing, but don't touch the... okay. Okay. Last two questions, true or false. Generally speaking, sex outdoors is better than sex indoors.
Same answer.
Attorneys are... All righty, unless that's the end of the lightning round, let's give a round of applause to Yvon Chouinard for getting through that. You had a moment when you looked closely at organic cotton and got surprised by what you found. What was that?
Well, it started with a retail store that we opened in Boston. We got an old building and we retrofitted it, opened it up, brought in all the clothing, and within 3 days, my employees were complaining they were getting headaches. And so I brought in a chemical engineer, and he did a study in the building. He said, the problem is your ventilation system is recycling the same air, and you're poisoning your employees. I said, well, wait a minute, where's the poison coming from? He said, well, it's all on all the cotton clothing that you've... This is before we did organic cotton. It's on all the cotton clothing that you have. It's formaldehyde. And formaldehyde is used to have stay-pressed clothing, no wrinkling. It helps the shrinkage and stuff. And formaldehyde, in biology class, you got a little bottle with a frog in it, and that's formaldehyde. And it's super toxic stuff. And in fact, they're still using it in hairdressing. to straighten out the curls in somebody's hair. And then when I heard that, I said, oh my God, I had no idea, because, you know, we just ordered cloth from a salesman. He'd come by with a big book on, and say, well, give me 10,000 yards of this and 5,000 yards of this. And I never thought about how it was made. And that was a wake-up call. And that's when we decided to start asking a lot of questions about what we were doing. And, you know, when we asked, well, okay, so what's happening with cotton? And so we went around and found out. We did trips to the Central Valley, and we visited cotton farms, and we got sprayed by crop dusters and found out the cancer rate's 10 times above normal in San Joaquin Valley there. And I said, I don't want to be in business if I got to use this stuff. You know, there's big ponds where they hire guys with shotguns and cannons to scare the birds away, because if they land on those ponds that are runoff ponds from these cotton fields, the birds have chicks with, you know, two beaks and three legs. And oh my God, I said, no, I can't do this. I'll go out of business before I use this stuff. So thankfully, I learned about organically grown cotton, and then we switched over. And then, you know, then we started asking more questions like, well, how about dyes? What happens? Are dyes toxic? I didn't know. I always just bought cloth already dyed. And so it was a long, long process in cleaning up my entire supply chain, all the way to the point where I know where now I have to go to our cotton farmers and say, it's not enough for you to grow organic cotton. Now you have to grow it regeneratively, which means the difference between organic and regenerative farming is regenerative builds topsoil and captures carbon. So that's way beyond organic. And so anyway, it led to us cleaning up our supply chain as much as we possibly could. Every time we learned we were doing something wrong, we changed it.
You're passionate now about food. You formed Patagonia Provision. So tell us about your passion for food and how you see food as a new avenue for the social change and concerns about climate change that you're talking about.
Well, agriculture is the biggest villain in climate change. And therefore, it's probably the best opportunity we have to do something about climate change. So growing cotton organically doesn't do the world any good. It's still, you know, for a brief period of time, it pulls carbon out of the air, sticks it in the ground, and then they plow it and it releases carbon again. So it's an endless process, and it loses topsoil. You know, the organic foods that you buy in your supermarket, most of it comes from Mexico, grown in Baja California, out in the desert out there, and is being forced to grow there. It uses fossil water that's millions of years old. It's probably 20 years left of the water there, never be replenished again. And, you know, they pay the workers $8 a day and lock them up at night so they don't escape. But it's organic. And so I said, I don't want to just, you know, our mission statement, the second part of our mission statement is cause no unnecessary harm. Well, I want to go beyond that. I want to do good. And so if I can get our people to grow cotton regeneratively, in other words, no more plowing, using cover crops, capturing carbon and leaving it in the soil, then it not only causes less harm, but it actually does good. And I think there's a lot of books out now, several books out, on the idea of capturing that carbon that we're releasing through agriculture, through different grazing practices. And it's pretty exciting. It's the most hopeful thing I've heard. In fact, we're partners in a bison farm in South Dakota. And we poked 250 holes in this pasture out there, this pasture land, to see how much carbon we're capturing compared to the neighbor's property, which has cows. Well, the bison property captures 9 tons more per hectare, so 2.2 acres, 9 tons more a year than the neighbor's. And why is that? Well, you know, the bison have little sharp hooves. Every time they walk, they make little divots. When it rains, water collects in the divots. When a cow walks, it's got these big flat feet, stomps the ground down. When it rains, the water runs off. And those little divots, they crush the grass and sticks it down into the ground. And so it's making its own cover crop and its own compost. And the bison roam around. They're never in one spot like cows are. So it's a much better animal to put on that on the plains than a cow is. So the University of California, Berkeley, and Santa Barbara have done studies on grassland, and they figure that if we change agriculture around the world, we could capture more than all the carbon that we're releasing into the air from everything that we do. But that means getting away from this industrial agriculture, which is John Jevons at Ecology Action up here in Willits. He figures we have 20 to 30 years more of topsoil. And before we run out of topsoil, we're going to run out of water. And regenerative agriculture, organic agriculture, uses 20% of the water of regular agriculture. And you can produce more food. So I'm really excited about that. And the reason I was in the clothing business, I thought I could change the industry and get other clothing companies to, by doing the right thing, proving that it's good business and that they would follow what we're doing. And you know what? It's not going to happen. I've watched all these companies pick the low-hanging fruit and then back off. And there's a bunch of companies now that are calling. Well, anyway, they have a... I'm pretty excited about
agriculture
food because I think we need a revolution in society. It's not going to come from any other way except from agriculture. I really believe that. People really care about, they don't care about how cotton is grown in Turkey, but they really care about food. And so I want to be part of that revolution. I want to be in my blacksmith shop sharpening the guillotines.
This is Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. If you're just joining us, we're talking about sustainability with Yvonne Chouinard, founder and owner of Patagonia and author of the new revised memoir, Let My People Go Surfing, The Education of a Reluctant Businessman. Before we go to audience questions, I want to ask you about your diet.
My diet?
Yeah. How have you changed your diet knowing what you know about climate change?
Well, I'm lucky in that I eat, as far as meat goes, I eat mostly game. I have friends that are hunters, and my freezer is just packed full of different game and stuff. I don't go to the supermarket and buy beef and stuff like that. So, but I still eat meat, but it is mostly game, and I do eat some bison and a lot of vegetables. I love wine. I try to eat locally, but I drink globally. I like old style, the old world style wines, not the new world heavy, high alcohol, heavy fruit wines. I don't like that.
Let's get you involved in the conversation. We're going to get as many of your questions in as we can here. We have about 28 minutes left, and we invite you. We have a lot of people who will have questions. One-part question. I'm here to help you if you need some help on that. And people are going to wave. We have some runners in the audience this time. So raise your hand. Put your hand up if you'd like to ask a question. And we have some runners. So the first one will be right here, and the second one will be right over there.
Sir, can you come over here, please?
Yeah, if you can come out to the aisle, that way we'll hold on to the mic. And
Howdy.
Let's go to our audience question for Yvonne Chouinard.
One of the big criticisms I hear about Patagonia is it's called Patagucci by a lot of the dirtbags in Yosemite. And I'm curious, I'm sure you've heard it as well, what is your response to a lot of the people that you would have hung out with that have this criticism against the company you run?
Well, you know, it's the same criticism with organic foods. People, a lot of people say they can't afford organic food because it's more expensive. And in fact, when you buy a hamburger at McDonald's, it's cheaper than if you bought all those ingredients separately. And that's because, you know, food is a commodity that's highly subsidized. And the efforts that we put into making our clothing is going to make them cost more than what you can buy at Costco or Walmart. But it is the same price as North Face or Marmot or any of those companies. And you know, I've had people say, well, why don't you make a less expensive range of clothes so that everybody can wear it? I can't do it. I can't. Organic cotton costs 3 times more per pound than regular cotton. Regular GMO, you know, all non-organic cotton is all GMO cotton. So I can't do it. I really believe that all of us should be buying less, but buying better. My father was a tradesman, and he taught me that when you buy a tool, you buy the absolute best tool you can get and keep it for the rest of your life. And that's much better than buying a cheap tool, having a break, buying another one, have that break. And so that's just the way it is.
Let's go to our next question here for Yvonne Chouinard.
As a B Corp yourself, what would you say is probably the biggest challenge that other CEOs of B Corps are going to face?
B Corporations.
You mean if you're not a B Corp or if you're...
If you are a B Corp, either considering becoming a B Corp or CEOs who are B Corps, what are the biggest challenges you see?
Well, you really have to live up to the standards. I mean, there's certain standards that are established, and you really have to live up to it, and they're not so easy. We're one of the cleanest companies in the world, and we've had to change a lot of our practices to live up to those B Corp standards. So you can't fake it.
Let's go here. Welcome.
Hi. I'm aware of the land purchasing that you and Doug Tompkins were doing in Argentina and Chile, and I really admire what you are doing. I visited the Iberá that Doug Tompkins was protecting. And I know you've come under a lot of criticism from the Argentine and Chilean people, and I'm wondering how you were dealing with that and if you're going to keep purchasing land.
I want to explain what's happening with
them.
Yeah,
I mean, my close friend Doug Tompkins, who just died last year kayaking with me, well, he and his wife have been working down in Argentina and Chile establishing national parks and reserves. And in the beginning, they were buying up properties from willing sellers, and this was, you know, right after Pinochet. And there were no environmental groups in Chile because nobody opposed the government. And he went down there and said, I'm buying this up and I'm going to make national parks and I'm going to give it back to you Chileans. And everybody said, oh, come on. You know, anybody, a lot of the wealthy families in South America got there by devious means. And they're not about to give their money away. And so here comes this gringo and says he's going to... There's no philanthropy in those places. But now that's changed. And in fact, just the other day, Chris Tompkins handed over 350,000 acres of new parkland to the country of Argentina. And these two people, Chris used to work for me. She was my CEO for 13 years when she was a teenager and graduating from high school. She was she wouldn't wear shoes. She was a beach girl and caused a lot of trouble in high school. And when the principal was talking to her parents and saying, "I know you're thinking of sending Christine to college. Don't bother." Doug Tompkins dropped out of school when he was 15 to go climbing with me. These two people, within 5 years, will have established over 12, probably 12 to 15 million acres of national parks in Argentina and Chile. Now, Yosemite is only 2.2 million. I mean, Yellowstone, which is one of our largest parks, is 2.2 million. So 12 to 15 million acres. That shows what two people can do that are absolutely motivated. And also, there's a lot of people donated money to this cause, and probably 100 people from around the world. So it wasn't just their money. They didn't have that much money. But it's a pretty amazing story.
I think that's worth a round. Yeah, that's about... let's go to our next audience question at Climate One for Yvonne Chouinard.
Hi, this is a fishing question. I was curious in that New Yorker article that was written about you at the end, excuse me, there was a great photo, or maybe it was at the beginning, of you working with some young Native kids and teaching them how to fish. I'm just interested in your motivation and what you're doing with that.
Yeah. I went to the Crow Indian Reservation, which is one of the toughest reservations around. I mean, high suicide rate with teens. And the Crows are not fishermen. They're buffalo hunters. But they live on the Bighorn River, which is one of the best rivers in America, and they're watching boat after boat after boat going down of rich white guys and being guided by non-Indians. And I thought, well, you know, I got to get these kids fishing and teach them a little bit about nature and stuff, and not in a way that that you'd normally teach them to fly fish, which is give them an $800 rod and a $500 reel and pay a guide $500 to take them down the river. So I went out there, I cut a branch off a tree, I put a horsehair line on it, twisted horsehair line and a leader, and I showed them how easy it is to fly fish. And so then I gave them these, it's called a tenkara pole. It's a pole without a reel and just has a line on the end. And so I wanted them to be able to relate to how simple it is to learn something like that. And in fact, I got every single one of them to catch fish. And I let them kill the fish. I mean, you know, they don't play with their food like we do. So... there was one kid who didn't catch a fish towards the end of the day, and he was 9 years old, and there was no reason he didn't catch a fish. So I took him out on a riffle, and he caught a 15-inch rainbow. So we killed that. And then he caught a 16-inch brown. We killed that. And then he caught a 17-inch rainbow, a big, beautiful fish. And he said, "I'm going to let this one go." I said, "How many are in your family?" He said, "Five." But I'm letting this one go. I said, well, by gosh, you're not only a great fisherman, but an environmentalist. And we put his fish on a little branch, and he walked back to the car where everybody was waiting and had a smile from ear to ear. And it was life-changing for those kids. I heard later on that their parents said the kids couldn't sleep at night. They were so excited. And so I've been going around teaching kids and women fly fishing. I won't teach guys. It's too frustrating.
We're talking with Yvonne Chouinard at Climate One from the Commonwealth Club. We have a next audience question over there.
So, Yvonne, you get to run a company that many people admire and offer your leadership voice and model for other leaders how to run a company and demonstrate to be a part of conversations to show other business leaders how to do that. Not all of us have that opportunity. First of all, thank you for that. For those of us who don't have that opportunity, and you've talked about values a little bit, how do we get other business leaders, whether they're young people or people that are already in a business leadership position, how do we get them to have more of the outlook that you have, and what can we do? Because we don't have the role that you do, but what role can we play, and what would you encourage many of us to do?
That's a good question. Well, we are influencing a lot of small companies. There's no doubt about it. The first edition of my book went out in 9 languages, went all over around the world. It's being used in universities and even high schools and business classes. We are influenced the young people. The bigger companies are pretty clueless. I was on a panel of a bunch of surf companies, the biggest surf companies in the world, and we're on a panel, and this is in the middle of the recession, and we talked about our businesses, and I talked about our supply chain, how we're cleaning up our supply chain, and then the CEO of one of the largest surf companies said, oh, yeah, well, we tried that before the recession. We made some hats and T-shirts out of organic cotton, but the recession hit, so we had to stop. So I said, well, how's your business doing? Well, we're down about 20%. In fact, they're in bankruptcy court now. And I said, well, gee, ours is up 30%. So eventually they'll find out that their customer has changed. I mean, all of us in this room, if we demand that they do the right thing, they'll have to. And that's the only way it'll happen, I think.
Next question over here for Yvonne Chouinard.
Hi, Yvonne. With such a large company with lots and lots of employees, how do you ensure that the company values are communicated and adhered to throughout the organization?
Well, that's why I wrote this book. It's basically for our own employees. The new edition has about 40% more content, a lot more about what we plan to do in the future, a lot more about agriculture and what we plan to do with Patagonia Provisions and management. So it's what we learned in the last 10 years, and it's basically written for my own employees, and each employee that gets hired gets a copy of the book and goes through kind of a values training thing so they know what they're buying into. That's why I did it.
Next question over here, and then down here, and over there.
Hi. I've been adventuring most of my life, and I find the clothing I wear almost becomes intertwined with the story. And I thought one of the most touching things that you all did a few years ago was open up the send it back to us, we'll repair it. I've been to your Reno shop, had many pieces repaired, and they still have life. If you could just speak to that innovation and what that has meant to your company.
Yeah, that kind of started. We did an ad in the New York Times on Black Friday that said, don't buy this jacket. And there's this photo of this jacket. And it said, don't buy this jacket without thinking twice. Do you really need it? Are you just bored? And if so, you know, don't be a kind of unconscious consumer. And Of course, we ended up selling more jackets than we ever did. But that wasn't the purpose. And what it did is it forced us, first of all, to put in the largest. We made our own commitment. If they made a commitment to think twice about purchasing, we were going to back it up with our own commitment, which was guaranteeing that jacket for life, repairing it when it needed repair, helping people find another owner for that jacket, and finally, when it's absolutely shredded and can't be used at all, we'll recycle it into more clothing. And so to do that, we had to build the largest garment repair facility in North America. And we have a van going around to colleges and stuff showing people how to repair clothes and repairing people's clothing. We produced a bunch of videos on how to sew a button on and so people can repair their own stuff. Because that's the best thing you can do is to buy the very best thing you can and try to keep it going as long as possible. And so we're helping people do that.
We're talking with Yvonne Chouinard with Climate One from the Commonwealth Club. Let's go to our next audience question, which is in the back. Yes.
Hi. I know you said at one point you thought designers might play a really big role in making change, and now you think maybe it's more on the consumer. But as a designer, what is your advice for us wanting to make change? Is it like who we work for? Is it the projects we choose? Do we need to start our own companies, or should we just quit and go into food, be chefs?
Well, you know, I gave a talk at Stanford at the design school, industrial design school. And this was years ago, and when I said that you should include environmental considerations in your design, the students said, you know, not one teacher has ever told us that. And a lot of companies think that it costs more money to do that. Well, I can tell you, if you don't do it, it's going to cost you a lot, because the customer has changed. But what I found is that it really doesn't cost you all that much more. It's just, if you haven't figured out how to do it, it's probably you haven't dug deep enough. You know, for instance, the absolute best fiber to be making clothing out of is hemp. Hemp uses no chemicals, uses no fertilizer, it's no pesticides, and it makes a phenomenal garment. It doesn't need to be ironed. But, you know, not very many companies are making clothing out of hemp. And it's just a lack of imagination, really.
We've got 10 minutes left. Let's go to the next question here for Yvonne Chouinard.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Earlier, you touched on a point that I would love to get back to, which was the moment you were on LCAP and your parents saw the image of you there. And then Greg asked, you know, what do you think about your own kids doing that type of thing? And I think it gets to this dilemma, which is our willingness to take on risk and adventure ourselves, but then bringing up a new generation of people and encouraging them to, no, stay home, do your homework. Don't necessarily do that same sort of adventure. So what is your advice to teenagers these days?
Oh, gee, teenagers. Well, my advice to parents is to stick your kids' necks out. Get them in nature. And, you know, when my kids were little toddlers and they'd climb up the fireplace, and I'd let them do it. Especially my daughter, you know, it's really a lot of parents will let the boy climb up, they won't let the daughter. And, you know, they get close to the fireplace. I let them get close enough the first time so that it hurt. Then I didn't have to worry about them after that. I really believe in And we got to get our kids out in nature because it's, you know, we have a child care center for our kids, and now we're worried about, I've got my grandkids in there, and my daughter does not want to send them to a public school where they hand them a computer or on their first day of school. Which, so, you know, we may have to expand our child care center to include a nature school. Where they're just out in nature every day. And I think that's far more important than getting them hooked on electronics, and which destroys their creativity completely and has, you know, they won't have any love for the planet at all.
Yvon Chouinard is the founder and owner of Patagonia and author of the new and updated memoir, Let My People Go Surfing, The Education of a Reluctant Businessman. I'm Greg Dalton. Our next question is back here. Yes.
Hi, this is a materials question. I work for a small prosthetic startup company, and as a prosthetics company, often we work with materials that are functional but not necessarily the best for the environment, things like carbon fiber, Texon, thermoformable plastics. I think as a company, a lot of us would love to follow in the footsteps of a company like Patagonia and source materials that are better for the environment but sometimes struggle to afford to do that. What advice would you have, or what would you do if you were in our position?
Oh, I don't know if I can help you or not. I think you got to think twice about the materials that you're using. Like, for instance, we have a Japanese company that wants us to partner with them in making polyester out of sugarcane. So not petroleum. So they can make exactly polyester without any compromises out of sugarcane. So what does that mean? I don't really know. If I go into it deep enough, it could very well be that it's better to make polyester out of oil. But unless we really start asking questions, and a lot of questions, and really getting deep into it, we could end up with unintended consequences.
Compete with food, takes lots of water. There could be lots of things there. Let's go to our next question for Yvon Chouinard right here.
Good evening, Yvon. Thank you for coming through to Campbell. My question is a piggyback off of the drinking globally. Just recently I noticed and have sampled some of your long root ale and this perennial root. And I was just curious, like, you know, what's the real story behind the curtain on getting into beer?
Well, we've been working with Wes Jackson at the Prairie Institute in Kansas, and he's been working for years on developing perennial wheat. Wheat used to be a perennial, and now it's an annual. The roots are this deep now. The stalk is only this high. It puts all its energy into the seed. And every time they plow, you know, the clouds of dust, they're losing topsoil like crazy. And anyway, it's a disaster. So he developed a perennial wheat. He's gone back, dehybridizing it, and has come out with a wheat called Kernza. And the roots are 15 feet deep. So it's drought resistant. It pulls nutrients up from way up. And you only plant it in September, and you harvest it in July, and it grows again. And it's the biggest advance in agriculture in 10,000 years, I think. So he was trying to figure out how to market it. So we said, well, let us market it. So we planted a bunch of wheat through the University of Michigan, and we ended up with 80,000 pounds of wheat. And then the FDA wouldn't let us sell it as food. They okay GMO food all day long, but they won't. They said you have to prove that it's food. Well, it took us 3 years and $50,000, and by that time the wheat was getting a little old. We couldn't just make it into flour. So we worked with a brewery in Oregon, and they made a beer out of it, and it's called Long Root Ale. It's not called Patagonia because Budweiser has copied the name Patagonia for beer. So it's Long Root Ale, and it's available now in... Yeah, Whole Foods heard about it. Whole Foods said, we want to put it in 500 of our stores. Well, there isn't that much beer. So they put it in 100 of their West Coast stores, and it's available in Whole Foods stores in the West Coast, and it's selling like crazy right now.
Question right here for Yvonne Chouinard.
Hey, Yvonne. I was just wondering, when are you planning on taking your personal next trip or expedition, and would you be open to taking a group of us with you? who's with us? Let's do this.
I just came back from 6 months in the Rocky Mountains, and it's the surf season now. I'm really anxious to try this arm out.
Our last question comes from Facebook. Brandon Pierce asks, how do you cultivate a durable sense of hope, both as an activist and as an entrepreneur?
Well, I don't know if it's hope. It's just like it's accepting your death. I've accepted that everything changes. I may not be trout fishing in Montana in the future. I may be fishing for walleye and smallmouth bass, and that's a big change, but that just may be. But you know what? I'm going to do what I can for this global warming is the overlying thing that is really, it's the only problem that we really have. It's the biggest thing. It's a cause for everything else that's going on in the world, and I'm going to do what I can with the resources that I have, which is my company, and some private philanthropy. And I'm going to sleep at night knowing that I'm a little part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
We have to end it there. Our thanks to... Oh, hold on. Youth and cuteness get you a long way in this world. We have one last question right there.
Why do you love nature?
Why do I love nature? Because I'm part of it. I'm really, you know, we're all in this together. We're all just, you know, when the scientists say that we're going to lose all the big animals first, we're a big animal. You know, we're in there with the polar bear and the grizzly bear and the elephant, and why shouldn't we be worried about ourselves like that? And so when you think about being part of nature, it's not that nature's over there and we're over here, but we're all in it together.
We have to end it there. We've been talking with Yvonne Chouinard, founder and president, CEO, founder and owner of Patagonia.
Thank you.
This is Climate One from the Commonwealth Club. We've been talking with Yvonne Chouinard, founder and owner of Patagonia, and author of the new updated memoir, Let My People Go Surfing, The Education of a Reluctant Businessman. I'm Greg Dalton.